This morning's scripture will be from Psalms 103, 6 through 11. The Lord executes righteousness and justice for all who are opposed. He made known his ways to Moses. He acts to the children of Israel. The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in mercy. He will not always strive with us, nor will he keep his anger forever. He has not dealt with us according to our sins, nor punished us according to our iniquities. For as the heavens are high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward those who fear him.
Good morning. It is good to be here. I'm not the normal guy who fills this pulpit, but I appreciate the opportunity. And we're going to be spending a lot of time in the book of Ruth this morning. If you want to turn there, we probably won't deviate that much from it. The book of Judges is an action-packed, gruesome book. It is God working on a grand scale, working through men and women to conquer armies and kingdoms, all so he can bring about salvation for his chosen people, people who don't deserve that salvation. It's over and over again. And throughout the book, we have a fat king being stabbed through the gut by a surprise strike from a left-handed warrior. We have tent pegs being driven through the skulls of Canaanite kings, Canaanite generals when they sleep. We have the ritual sacrifice of 70 brothers to secure a tenuous and very temporary throne. We have the superheroics of one man armed with nothing but the jawbone of a donkey and the Spirit of the Lord, killing a small army single-handedly. And the book of Judges ends with the raping and killing of a concubine, an event that sparks a civil war that nearly wipes out one of the 12 tribes. And the final verse of the book says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." So in the context of all this mayhem and violence, we get to the book of Ruth. So this small book zooms in on just a few people. The scale isn't nearly as large, and the most action-packed scene is just a conversation that takes place at the gates of Bethlehem. But the Lord is working through these people, and he orchestrates a salvation that is no less impressive than what he does in Judges. The theme of the book of Ruth is the word hesed. It's used this word over and over again throughout the book, and it's often translated as loving-kindness. And the ESV translates it as steadfast love in many of the Psalms, just like in Psalm 103 that was read for us moments ago, or mercy, loving kindness, us. We don't actually have a word for it in English that really encapsulates the meaning adequately. It's a relational term that seems to wrap up all of the positive attributes of God. It's going beyond all obligation, going way beyond what any reasonable person would expect, showing love and kindness without any thought of advantage one might gain in the exchange. So hesed never asks, "What's in it for me?" It is beyond even covenant faithfulness. God continually acts with hesed toward his people. He is constantly going above and beyond to not only save, but bless his people. And even now, God doesn't save us through Jesus, so we can stay alive just to beg for scraps at the table. No, he saves us and then raises us up to sit at the table of the king. He makes us like sons in his household. And this is nothing we should expect because it's nothing we deserve. So even getting scraps from the table would be an infinite mercy for us. Grace upon grace. Even being treated as dogs would be mercy. But God acts with hesed toward his people. And in the book of Ruth, we will see destitute people on the brink of ruin, raised up and blessed beyond their imagination. If you have not got a family report yet, you can raise your hand, and there's some men here that will pass it out to you. There's some outline there that will help you follow along if you need it. So, the book of Ruth we'll be driving toward this lifting up of these destitute people, because we'll see several people in the word use this word over and over again in the story. And we'll highlight those when we get to them, but we'll see that the use of the word always refers in some way to the title character of Ruth. She's either going to be the target of it or she's going to be on the peripheral. Indeed, Ruth is God's primary instrument here to bring Hesed toward a poor, grieving widow. In Psalm 107, the final verse, the psalmist instructs us, "Whoever is wise, let him attend to these things. Let them consider the steadfast love, the Hesed of the Lord." So we will start digging in verse 1. "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion." So here we have a Jewish family going away from the land of promise because of a famine. And the opening of this story should start ringing a few bells in our head, because this is a familiar plot device in Scripture. Each of the patriarchs are involved in stories that begin in the exact same way. Abram, eventually Abraham, he goes to Egypt because of a famine. And he comes out rich, his household enlarged. Isaac goes to Abimelech in Philistia, again because of a famine, and he comes out better than he was before. And then Jacob and his large family go down to Egypt, again because of a famine. And then 400 years later, Israel comes out a mighty nation, and the text says that they plundered the Egyptians. So Egypt was just so eager to see them leave that they threw gold at them. They came out far richer than they were before. In each of these stories, they come back to the promised land stronger than they were than when they left the promised land. So as this story begins, we might be expecting the same thing: preservation and abundance. But our expectations are going to be subverted. Instead, we are going to get death and emptiness. So Elimelech dies. His two sons die. Soon it's just Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, the women that her sons had married in Moab. And everyone is a childless widow. They're left without any protection, with no covering, with no future. But Naomi hears that the Lord has blessed his people with food, and so they start the journey back to the land of Judah. In verse 8, Naomi has the first use of the word of Hesed in the book and prays that God would show Hesed upon her two daughters-in-law, that they would find husbands. And that is their only chance to survive. Not only survive, but secure a future for themselves. Orpah does eventually turn back to her family. It is the eminently reasonable thing to do in this circumstance. Perhaps her family can help her find another husband. And admittedly, Naomi was very persuasive, starting in verse 11, saying, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your own way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying?" As she frames it, she's right, absolutely correct. And Orpah does listen to her exhortation to leave. But despite Naomi's bitter pleas, Ruth clings to Naomi. And in verse 16, utters that great proclamation of loyalty: "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." So they get back to the promised land, and specifically Bethlehem. And the time was around the barley harvest, which is going to be important later on. So that's the setup for the story. That's chapter 1. And immediately we are introduced to a man named Boaz, the relative of Elimelech. And in Ruth chapter 2, verse 1, Boaz is introduced to us as a mighty man of wealth, as the King James Version puts it. The ESV calls him a worthy man, and other versions basically just interpret it to mean a man, a prominent man of influence. But the word carries much more meaning than that, and we should not gloss over it. So the description of Boaz as a mighty man is the same word used to describe David's mighty men of valor, his military retinue of men who slayed giants with him. So Boaz was a Gibor Hayil. Boaz was actually a man who had proved himself in battle. He has that reputation, although he's older now, so he might be a retired soldier at this point. But remember, this is during the time of the judges. This was a time of war and battles. It might be one of the reasons why Naomi's sons had died at this time. But we can get a general idea of exactly when this was by looking at some of the ancestors of Boaz. At the end of Ruth chapter 4, we learn his grandfather was a man named Nashon. Nashon was part of the generation of the wilderness, right after Egypt. And he was a man of prominence. He represented the whole tribe of Judah in several important matters. And in 1 Chronicles 2, he is called a prince of the sons of Judah. His sister, Nashon's sister, married Aaron, the high priest. So today in Yiddish, to call someone a Nashon is to say that they are out front. They're making things happen. They are someone prominent and important. So that's Boaz's grandfather. His father is Salmon. And Salmon helped fight the initial battles in the Promised Land, including the Battle of Jericho. And an interesting fact is that Salmon married Rahab. Rahab, who had the spies, who hid the spies and secured salvation from that doomed city for herself, who threw herself at the mercy of God in the best way she knew how at the time. So this might be one of the reasons why he was so ready to bestow such kindness on a foreigner, Boaz, because who was Boaz's mother? It was Ruth, or not Ruth, but it was Rahab. His own mother was a former foreign prostitute. So when it says Boaz is a man of prominence, a mighty man, it's not just a light thing. There's a lot packed in there. He is a descendant of Nashon, related to the high priest's family by marriage, a man with great reputation, very well known, and proven in battle. So it's a little weird that Naomi has called herself a dead end. She has instructed everyone to call her bitter, that there's essentially no hope. But she has completely forgotten about Boaz, this prominent man of wealth who is a relative. And that can be one of the traps of grief. You can become so blind to something that can rescue you. You can disparage the God plans that God has made for you. Sometimes our grief can grow so much that it dims the eyes of faith, and it gives us an excuse to wallow in self-pity. But thanks to Ruth, Naomi is going to get another chance to look with eyes of faith, and this time she does see the opportunity. And Ruth goes to glean in the fields to help provide food for her and Naomi. And so according to the law, the owners of a field were not allowed to harvest up to the edges of their fields, nor were they allowed to go back and pick up grain that they had forgotten or dropped during the harvest. Over and over again, God says that these gleanings, what they were called, are for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. So it was a straightforward way to provide some sustenance for the poor. And so this is what Ruth is taking advantage of here, being both a sojourner and a widow. She starts to gather up grain that the reapers have left behind, and she ends up in the field of Boaz. And Ruth works hard. We are told she works from early morning all the way until evening, and there's just a short break that she takes and some time for a meal. And during this time, Boaz appears, and we start to learn what kind of character he has. He seems to immediately notice this industrious woman. Something calls his attention to her, and he inquires about who she is, and after he learns that she is Naomi's daughter-in-law, he gives her some preferential treatment. And this is where Boaz himself starts showing hesed, starts going above and beyond what is expected of him. He enlists his own men to guard her, because these are dangerous times. There have been raids from other nations. He invites her to keep coming back to his field to glean, to not go to another. He tells her to follow along behind the actual reapers so that she can get the first pick of the gleanings, of the grain that they drop in the course of their reaping. The water that is usually reserved for his workers, he gives her access to, which is no small thing. We're used to easy access to water in our modern times, but then it's going to be a precious resource that had to be gathered. And then at mealtime, he gives her bread and wine. He shares a meal with her. And then finally, he tells his men to just grab some of the bundles that have already been harvested and leave them for her to glean, as if that wasn't enough. So he shares some of the actual harvest with her. And his own explanation for this comes in chapter 2, verse 11. He says, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So that's how Boaz frames her clinging to Naomi, coming to the Lord for refuge. And remember how he phrases that, because we're going to refer back to that in a moment, and Ruth refers back to it in the next chapter. But Boaz is not one to say, "Go in peace, be warmed and filled, and then do nothing," like the man of dead faith in James chapter 2. Boaz calls down a blessing of the Lord on Ruth, and then immediately maneuvers to be an instrument of that very blessing. And as a result, Ruth brings home a full ephah of barley. So this, we don't know exactly how much that was, but it was at least 7 gallons of grain. That's quite a haul for a day's work. And after seeing what Ruth had gleaned and the leftover food from the meal, Naomi correctly deduces that a man has taken notice of you, hasn't he? A man has taken notice of her and blessed her. Normal gleaning would not result in this much bounty, not even close. And after hearing the name of Boaz, Naomi uses the word hesed again in verse 20. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness, hesed, has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "This man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So Ruth continues to glean in the field of Boaz until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. So this at least goes on for several days. We don't know how long. It was longer than just a day. Now, if the story stopped here, it would be a nice little anecdote, a fine example of the Lord taking care of a widow and a sojourner in a time of distress, beyond what they might have expected even. But this is a story about the hesed of the Lord. And while at this point they seem taken care of, they're not going to starve, God is just warming up, really. Now remember that there has been a famine in the land, and the reason Naomi has come back is because there's now food in Israel. So harvest time in general was a time of celebration. But after the harvest of barley, after the first harvest of barley, after a famine, it would probably doubly so. Lots of celebration here. Time of great feasting and drinking while the threshing and winnowing was going on. It was a lot of work. And so a lot of the men who did it would just sleep next to the floor, sleep on a pallet. They wouldn't really go home. They would just sleep and get up and keep working. So Naomi knows what Boaz is going to be doing and where he will be. And she tells Ruth what to do, and Ruth obeys. And part of the instruction is to wash and anoint yourself. So essentially, take a bath, put on some perfume. Not the worst advice in the world, especially if you're going to go to propose to someone, as Ruth is about to do. So Ruth hangs back during the celebrations, but after Boaz has had his fill, he lays down to go to sleep, and Ruth approaches. She uncovers his feet, lays down at his feet, but after the whole scene is quite humorous. In chapter 3, starting in verse 8, "At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, 'Who are you?' And she answered, 'I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer.'" So she asked for Boaz to spread his covering over her, which is just another way of saying, "Make me your wife." So if you can imagine waking up in the middle of the night and there's this woman, "Make me your wife." Say, okay. But even more, she uses the same terminology that Boaz used earlier when he called down a blessing upon her, that the Lord would reward her because she has come to seek refuge under his wings, under the Lord's wings, under the Lord's covering. Now Ruth is saying to Boaz, you can be an instrument in the Lord's blessing, for which you yourself have asked. But Ruth also calls him a redeemer. And many translations are going to say close relative or something like that, but it's really redeemer, like the ESV puts it. And the laws for the kinsman redeemer are laid out in Leviticus 25 regarding buying back a relative who had been sold into slavery or had sold themselves into slavery. And then Deuteronomy 25 about marrying a childless widow and therefore providing a path where land and possessions could be inherited. The first child born from such a union would be counted as the child of the original husband, so that that man's line and inheritance would not fade away. And Boaz has some words of praise for Ruth as soon as he recognizes her and realizes what's going on, rubs the sleep from his eyes. In verse 10, he says, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness, hesed, greater than the first, and that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. So there's that word again, hesed. This hesed is greater than the first because she could have gone after younger men to take care of herself. And you get the sense here that Ruth is a very attractive woman and not just an inward virtue. Implied in this also is that Ruth has been showing hesed to Naomi all along. All that she has done up to this point has been hesed, above and beyond in taking care of her mother-in-law. And remember that Boaz notices her in the field among the other women. There's something about her. And then Naomi tells her to stay back during the party, maybe so none of the other men would take notice of her, since she is now dressed up, covered with a cloak, essentially to seduce a man, propose to him. Perhaps she could have had her pick, and Boaz knows it. And this hesed is even greater than the first that Ruth showed to Naomi, of following her and helping to take care of her. If she had not sought to marry a redeemer, then Naomi would still lose everything. Ruth would have a new family to take care of, and Naomi would have no true descendants of her own. So in the course of this praise, Boaz says that everyone knows that Ruth is a woman of noble character, or a virtuous woman. And these words here are literally Isha Hayil. This is in contrast, of course, to Boaz's description as a Gibor Hayil. Boaz is what a man of excellence looks like. But Ruth is what a woman of excellence looks like. It's interesting that these are the same words used in Proverbs 31:10. An excellent wife, or virtuous wife, or wife of noble character, who can find? And the words used there, again, are Isha Hayil. And the connection was so strong that some ancient teachers even wanted to put Ruth right after Proverbs, as if an answer to the question, who can find a virtuous wife? Well, Boaz can, apparently. There are a lot of other parallels. The woman in Proverbs 31:15 gives food to her household. Ruth obviously does the same, working so hard that the overseer makes special note of her work ethic. Proverbs 31:23 says that her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the city. And in the next scene, we are going to see Boaz sitting at the gates among the elders of the city. Ruth is seeking out the right kind of husband. And at the end of Proverbs 31, it says, her works will praise her in the gates. When Boaz, in verse 11, says that all the people in the city know what kind of woman she is, that she's a woman of excellence, the translation is trying to get a sense of a Hebrew idiom there. But literally, Boaz is saying that all the gates of the city know what kind of woman she is. And later, there are going to be many people at the gates who are going to rain down blessings upon her. So when we read of Ruth, we are reading the live example in Scripture of the Proverbs 31 woman. So Boaz is going to make sure, after this, that Naomi and Ruth are redeemed, one way or another. First, he needs to go to the one who is actually supposed to be the redeemer, because there's a relative closer in the tree, so to speak. Boaz goes to the gate. That's where the elders of the city sat in judgment. That's where there was going to be witnesses for anything that took place. And it was also a choke point, so if you wanted to find someone for an important matter, they'd probably be passing through at some point during the day. You couldn't exactly ring them up on the phone. So Boaz sees the Redeemer and calls him aside. And he says, sit down here, friend. And the words translated friend here are actually another Hebrew idiom. And the King James translates it pretty well, such a one or a certain one. The equivalent, essentially, of John Doe or what's his face. So, come over here, what's your face? Now, it's unlikely Boaz just didn't know the guy's name because he's a close relative, but rather this is being used for rhetorical effect for the story, and we're going to see why in a minute. But Boaz gradually reveals the situation to what's his face. First, he tells him that Naomi's land must be redeemed. Buy it now or let him know so Boaz can buy it. And the guy's response after this is, yeah, I'll redeem it. Sounds good. So case closed. It seems what's-his-face is going to take care of the situation. But Boaz adds the other stipulation. A piece of very important information that he withheld at first, maybe strategically. Whoever buys the land must also marry Ruth and raise up the line of Elimelech on the inheritance. Suddenly, what's-his-face isn't near as enthusiastic about the matter. It's like, no, can't really do that. So what changed? Why was he willing before, but not willing now, after he learns of Ruth? Initially, he probably thought he was going to be marrying Naomi, who was old, could not have any children. So if he redeemed the land and the line of Elimelech ended, what happened to the land? This guy, what's-his-face, would get to keep it. It's a nice profit, because normally land could not be bought and sold permanently like that. There were strict stipulations in the law to prevent anyone from permanently losing the inheritance that God himself had given them, given their family in the promised land. And in the year of Jubilee, everything was supposed to revert back to the original owners anyway. But in this situation, it could have changed possession permanently, because there would be no one to inherit. It's quite a good business opportunity, possibly a rare one. But Ruth enters the picture. She has a good chance of providing an heir, a continuation of the line, so he would be spending all his money just to give it back to the line of Elimelech, acting like an actual redeemer. And that is not such a great business opportunity. So he begs off. He says it will jeopardize or ruin his inheritance. He can't put his money toward an enterprise like that. There's a strange ritual with the sandal wherein Boaz seals the deal, and then the witnesses give a couple of blessings for the union at the gate. And one of these blessings is very strange, and we'll get to that in a moment. But the first blessing is a wish that Ruth be like Leah and Rachel. And that makes sense. The original mothers of the nation of Israel. That blessing makes perfect sense, sure. But then they say, may your house be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore, because of any offspring that came from this union. And you're like, whoa, wait a minute. That might surprise us a little bit, especially for familiar with the story, a bit unexpected. Essentially saying, may Ruth be like Tamar. Not exactly something you wish on someone else's wife. At least the way we typically understand the story. Because you remember the story of Judah and Tamar from Genesis 38. Because it's not a story we typically teach kids in the Bible class. There's not coloring sheets in the room for this story. But right after Judah sells his brother Joseph into slavery, he finds a wife for his son, and this wife was named Tamar. But the son dies, so Judah gives his other son to Tamar, telling him to do the duty of a brother-in-law, to raise up offspring for his dead brother. But this son, named Onan, refuses to do his duty, and God strikes him dead. And Judah should have given his third son to Tamar, but he refuses, and so Tamar takes matters into her own hands. She pretends to be a prostitute and succeeds in getting Judah to lie with her, and as a result, she conceives. And the result of this union is Perez. So in the genealogy at the end of Ruth begins with the same, Perez. So of all the people in the Old Testament to start the genealogy of David off with, King David, the man after God's own heart, the great warrior poet of Israel, the archetypal king that God will raise up, why Perez? May your house be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Naomi, you will be blessed if Ruth ends up being like Tamar. It seems like a very odd blessing indeed, doesn't it? But they are seeing the bigger picture of the story. They understand what's happening, and that what happened with Tamar is in the background of what's happening here with Naomi and Ruth, and they are forever linked. The word the first redeemer, what's-his-face, uses when he says that marrying Ruth would ruin or jeopardize his inheritance, more literally ruin, it's the same word used when Onan ruins or wastes his seed because he didn't want to raise up offspring for his brother. He didn't want to be a redeemer for his brother's line, so there's a direct link between Onan and this unknown relative in Ruth. Both abdicated their responsibility. And when we get to the genealogy of Jesus, the first three women mentioned in that line are Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth, two of which are prostitutes, or were. So the story of Tamar colors the story of Ruth. It rhymes, so to speak. Both are the story of a foreign widow who throws herself at the promised line. And as a result, God provides deliverance and brings that woman into the promised line. A woman who's been cast off and seemingly abandoned, and God comes in and has mercy. And by all accounts, none of these women should be there as an ancestor of Jesus. They should not be part of the line of the Messiah to be mentioned alongside kings. They knew they didn't belong. Not really. They weren't really trying to make a name for themselves. All they were trying to do was survive. Just survive. Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth. In the best way they knew how at the time. And each in their own way simply threw themselves at the mercy of God. Likewise, by all rights, none of us should be here. None of us deserves to be called sons of the living God. Not one of us deserves the inheritance that is promised to us. I mean, who here, if all of their sins were projected on these screens, every idle word and thought, every single one, who here would have anything to boast about? Not one of us. Not a single one of us. But God allows us to boast in something, doesn't he? In Christ and him crucified. In our Redeemer. And in the end, the other so-called Redeemer, what's-his-face, walks away happy because his inheritance is secure. His barns will be full. He has just dodged a huge bullet in his mind. And yet, history knows him only as what's-his-face. He grasped for himself, and now his name is forgotten. And meanwhile, what happens to Boaz and Ruth? They are in the line of kings, ancestors of King David, and then of King Jesus. And history will never forget their names. This is a great example of Jesus' teaching that those who are last will be first. Those who lose their life will find it, will actually gain it. And it's a good lesson for us today as well. By the end of the book, we have the stage set for the next act of God's plans for Israel. The coming of the king, the man after his own heart, who will be an ancestor of the greater king, the greater Gibor Hayil than even Boaz. And that king stood in the gap and died in your place. He died and he rose again so that you might have life. In the grand story of redemption, each and every one of us is in the position of Naomi and Ruth, of Tamar, of Rahab. We need a redeemer to secure our future. And God has graciously provided that redeemer in his son, in the man called Jesus. He knows you have nothing to offer him. There's nothing he needs from you. But he loves you anyway. He desires for you to sit at his table. He desires to lift you up and give you a seat with kings. He desires to name you as his own, to act with hesed toward those who call upon his name. So, what are you waiting for? Don't be like what's-his-face. Consider the steadfast love of the Lord. Consider the hesed of God. Have your name written in the book of life and remembered forevermore. If there's anything we can do to help you today, if you please come forward as we stand and sing?